In her new book, the scholar Sarah Patterson says, by 1993, leaders with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints were ready to act on decades of institutional labor. That is, church officials had been keeping an eye on this growing movement of intellectuals and scholars and feminists who were challenging church authority and raising these questions about history and doctrine. And the leaders wanted to manage and rein in all of these new ideas, so they set up what Patterson describes as a system of purity. In September, it all began. On the 14th, the Mormon feminist Lynn Whitesides had her church membership suspended. On the 15th, a conservative Hebrew scholar named Avraham Gileadi was excommunicated. Paul Toscano, who had accused leaders of what he called ecclesiastical tyranny, was excommunicated on September 19th. Maxine Hanks also lost her membership on the 19th, not long after she edited a collection of essays and papers about LDS feminist theology. On the 23rd, the feminist writer Lavina Fielding Anderson. On the 26th, the historian Michael Quinn. Add it up. Six people. The September 6th is how they're often described. We talked to Maxine Hanks, one of the six, this week, and she told us the floodgates may have opened on that September, but for years, she had felt it was coming.
There was a burst, a kind of a zeitgeist of feminist theology. And I knew it was dangerous because very few women wanted to talk about it in public. It was all done in private. We were talking about women in priesthood, LDS origins, and Mother in Heaven. And it was concerning or disorienting for leaders who hadn't seen this before. But I felt really a spiritual call to gather this information together and compile it in a book, knowing that it would get me in trouble. And it was in 1990 and 91 that I began to get pushback from leaders who were aware of what I was working on. It became kind of a race. Would I finish the book first, or would I be disciplined by the church first? And I began to be interviewed. I was being asked to curb back what I was presenting, you know, not talk about the Mother in Heaven, not talk about women and priesthood. And I knew that I needed to do that. That's what the book was about. So I knew we were at odds. And when the book came out in early 1993 and church leaders saw the whole package, there was a real reaction. I was called in for a series of interviews that year from February to August, where the state president read the book, had underlined portions, and was asking me specific questions. Discipline was inevitable. I just had to brace myself to keep going and stand up for the work we'd done because I knew we'd done good work. By July, I knew what was coming. Part of me wanted to resign from the church and say, you know, you can't fire me, I quit. I'm a scholarly person, but I'm also a deeply spiritual person. So part of me wanted to have a higher spiritual guidance. And I prayed for an answer. I was just at home in my bedroom, lying on my bed, meditating and praying to get a higher sense of guidance or wisdom for things that I was doing. When that sense comes, it's undeniable. It's outside of my own frame of reference. The answer that came really surprised me. You need to be excommunicated. you need to go through this. It's destined. Many people are going to learn from this. I was so grateful for that spiritual impression. I needed that to go through what was coming in September. I realized that we dissenters, scholars, feminists were praying for divine guidance and felt we were doing the right thing. But our leaders were also. They were praying for divine guidance and felt that they were doing the right thing. God didn't take sides. It was required that all of us play the parts that we played in order for this whole thing to happen, so that all of us could learn things that we needed to learn about the church and about ourselves.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with Sarah Patterson about this era in Mormonism, a bona fide purging of members who wouldn't subscribe to the purity system. Patterson is a professor of theological studies at Hanover College. Her book is called The September Six and the Struggle for the Soul of Mormonism. And it's that struggle part of the title where we began the conversation.
That's actually a comment that Levina Fielding Anderson, who was one of the six, made. It seemed to me that the church and some of its members who are pushing back against how the church was framing its theology, as well as its community, it seemed to me that that phrase really captured the intensity of that struggle.
You write that there are these kind of two patterns that emerged about the September 6th excommunications. And one is that the church was sending a clear message, look, stay in line or just get out. That was one of these patterns. But the other perspective was that keeping people in line or disciplining people who strayed from the Orthodox doctrine was, you know, that's unfortunate that we have to do this, but it's necessary to keep the church really stable as it's growing around the world. And it seems like what you're arguing in the book is both of those views are kind of oversimplified.
I think that there was a lot going on in the institutional church that led to that set of choices about disciplinary actions. There are certainly a lot of ways that a religious institution can address its members who are not necessarily towing the line from the institution's perspective. And so I think that more sympathetic views tend to suggest that what was happening was a necessary thing in order to hold the church together. But I think that it's important for us to think about kind of what all of the options were, both from the institution's perspective and from the dissenter's perspective. And I think that that gives us a much more complex story.
You say that the story is about kind of this different understanding of what it meant for the LDS Church to be a restoration church. The six who were excommunicated and various others, of course, that believed one thing about that, and church leaders, you know, I guess the old guard, the traditionalists, they believed something else about what it meant to be a restoration church. Now, first, explain what you mean by a restoration church. This isn't going to be clear to everyone listening.
Kind of at the basic level, a restoration church has a particular view of history. And so in this instance, it's the idea that when Jesus was alive, he created the true church on earth. And that over time, after his death and after the disciples' death, that true church lost its way. And so eventually, the true church disappeared from the earth. And in LDS storytelling, it was important for God to restore that true church. So that's where the word restoration comes from. And so through Joseph Smith, God restored the true church that had been lost.
And the dispute or the different understanding about that. How does that work? How did reformers like the September 6th want to interpret what it meant for the LDS Church to be a restoration church? You say they believe Joseph Smith's church was kind of a radical move, that he democratized some of these theological ideas. He made the idea of new experiences and spiritual authority something that wasn't just the domain of a priest, but for everyone. That's where the reformers like the September 6th were thinking. Is that it?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's important that we think about how both the institution and dissenters were looking to history for their evidence. And that's why so many of the struggles that happened during that time period happened over how history was told. And they weren't all saying the same things, but I do talk about how there are themes and what they were saying. And one that really stands out to me is this idea that Joseph Smith was searching for the truth. Mm-hmm. And so when believers are being faithful, part of that activity is seeking out the truth wherever it leads you. And that's something that you really see in Mike Quinn's work, who was one of the six, and also David Wright, who was excommunicated maybe half a year after the September 6th. I also saw in the six an emphasis on egalitarianism. And the idea that the church that Joseph Smith restored really focused on every believer playing a role and every believer having access to spiritual authority.
So you have this on sort of on one side, that perspective. And then on the other side, which is they're church leaders, right? Which is a more kind of orthodox approach. This is the sort of the traditional, or what came to be thought of, I guess, is the traditional approach because it's contested. But the idea that if you just let everyone think what they think and have their own personal sense of revelation, they're going to be all over the place. You need some sort of centralized power. You need some sort of doctrinal purity that everyone adheres to. And that's the other side, right? That's the case that church leaders, especially there then in the 90s, were making, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, part of that ties back to just the framing of a restoration history. If the true church was once on earth and then was lost, when it's restored, I think there's always the sense that there's a danger that it could be lost again. And so I think it makes sense that church leaders would be asking questions about how do we manage this diversity of thought and perspective and membership. And so I think they turn to the idea of purity as a way to try to manage that.
The idea of the dispute between the old guard and, you know, intellectuals and reformers like those among the September 6th, some of those you could think of as kind of abstract. But what about some specific doctrinal points? It seems you have kind of that traditionalist approach or a kind of a literal approach. The, you know, there is, for example, a literal reading of Scripture, a literal interpretation of church history. That, for example, there was an ancient Israelite family that made its way to the American continent around 600 BCE, and that story is told in the Book of Mormon. That actually happened. That wasn't a myth. That thing happened. But then there's the other approach, which is this, you know, historical critical approach that you get from some of the people who were excommunicated that said, we don't need to take any of those things literally. Don't presume those things actually happened. There's a way to read those stories as conveying lessons and meaning and moral principles. Where did that idea of literal interpretation of actual sort of the historicity part, how did that play out in this larger story?
I think questions about historicity became more important and more central as there were scholars who were asking questions about the historicity of the text, if that makes sense. And And somebody like David Wright was making the argument that it was really important for the church to have a space where believers could read the text and find meaning in ways that weren't tied to the history.
Yeah.
His scriptural studies had led him to the position that the Book of Mormon was a 19th century text and not an ancient text. And he talked about how if you read the text as revelation for its larger truths and larger meaning, that could still preserve Joseph Smith as an inspired individual, mm-hmm. that you didn't have to throw away the idea that Smith was a prophet if you turned away from the idea that the text was history.
But it's interesting the way you mention how this filtered down to his local leader, because you mention his bishop peppering him with questions. So David Wright has this idea that, gosh, you don't really need to believe that that thing actually happened to believe Joseph Smith was a religious innovator and a prophet. But what his bishop asks him really pins him down. Here are some of the questions you include in the book. Do you believe that Joseph Smith was a prophet? Do you sustain Joseph Smith as a prophet? Now, those David Wright can deal with fairly easily. But then he gets to, do you believe that Joseph Smith was visited by John the Baptist and received the Aaronic priesthood from him? In other words, these rigid questions. I don't know if he specifically asked, do you actually believe there were golden plates? Do you actually believe that there was an Israelite family that's made its way across the ocean? But he was really pinning him down. And David Wright sort of was trapped by that, I guess. He couldn't give an abstract answer or a nuanced answer to that kind of specific question.
And I think that that story is a reflection of the purity system, that Wright was looking for nuance and the bishop was not. The way that the questions were framed didn't allow for anything except for yes or no answers. And at least from Wright's perspective, he was asked that kind of question over and over again and felt, I think, like he was being tested for doctrinal purity.
Sarah Patterson, her book is The September 6th and the Struggle for the Soul of Mormonism. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. Let's talk about the church's purity system as you describe it in the book. This gets us to a person named Boyd K. Packer. I think a lot of people will know that name. He's a former high-ranking leader in the church, thought of as quite doctrinaire, quite conservative in the way he saw the way the church should be managed. And you write about how Packer gives this speech to a church council. This is about 4 months before the September excommunications in 1993. And I want to ask you about what he says. You write in the book that he was worried the church had, the church that, as you put it, that he had dedicated his life to was moving in the wrong direction. Talk about this speech that he gives.
I think it's a speech that's often remembered as kind of encapsulating the position of the church hierarchy. He talked about three enemies or dangers to the church that the All Church Coordinating Council needed to be looking out for. And it was three groups. One he called so-called intellectuals. So he was concerned about the scholarship that was happening, that believers were doing, that he felt called into question a lot of what had been considered true in the church for a long time. The second group he was concerned about were feminists. And then the third group was the gay and lesbian movement. And so he was talking to the group that he was charging to help protect the doctrinal purity of the church.
Maxine Hanks said that what Packer had done was name the shadow. What did she mean by that?
I think part of what Maxine was capturing when she said that was that Packer was one of the church leaders who was outspoken about what his concerns were. And so he was naming fears that might have been present in a lot of other members of the church hierarchy, but that they wouldn't necessarily have named. But because of his personality and his boldness and his desire to protect the church, he was willing to do that.
How did the purity system work? There are three basic pillars, which I think it's important to maybe mention these. Talk a little bit about this, the pillars of the way the church saw this purity system.
So the first pillar that I talk about is the doctrinal pillar, which was the concern of a lot of members of the church hierarchy. In October 1993, the top leaders of the church issued a statement that said, "We are responsible for the doctrinal purity of the church." So it was about trying to communicate to believers that being an insider meant that you assented to a certain set of beliefs. The second pillar that I talk about, I call the familial pillar.
Yeah.
And that was about how the home was structured. The goal is to have every aspect of a church member's life be tied to their understanding of God. And so the second pillar was about the home and how the home and the family were structured. And there was a real emphasis on heterosexual monogamy as the kind of central relationship in the family. And there was also the ideal vision of that relationship was one of gender complementarity, where men and women were seen as having different traits that were important to the functioning of the family.
So traditional nuclear family, that was one of the pillars here. The other one you write about is bodily and sexual purity. How did that work?
In the late 20th century, there was concern in some members of the hierarchy about what people were taking into their bodies. So there was the emphasis on the word of wisdom, but also there was a lot of fear of same-sex sexuality. And part of what I talk about is there was an idea that there was an especial concern about the sexuality of men and a sense that if a man engaged in sexual activity with another man, that would make his body impure, but that would also potentially contaminate the entire church body.
One of the questions that comes up is whether this purge was also happening to right-wing members of the church. As you say, there were a number of these ultra-conservative church members who were being excommunicated and disciplined and warned by church leaders at the time. Tell us a little bit about this part of the story.
At that same time, as you said, there were right-wing, ultra-conservative members who were being excommunicated. And the way that the story often gets framed is that it tells that alongside the story of the six and suggests that the church was at the center and excommunicating people who were on the extreme fringes on either side. And I think that that's a problematic way of telling this story for a number of reasons. But one is that it suggests that the institution was acting in a neutral kind of way, that it was kind of going towards the middle. And so I think it masks the ways that the institution was aligning itself with the religious right. And so I call this story the middle of the road narrative. And some of the members of the September 6th embraced that narrative. And part of what I think they were doing was explaining the presence of Abraham Gileadi in the September 6th because he was different from the others.
Yeah, conservative.
Yes, he was conservative. And he was excommunicated in part because his work was appealing to those ultra-conservatives. His interpretations of Isaiah were inspiring those ultra-conservatives to make choices like homeschooling their children, food storage kind of taken to the extreme. Some of them were going out into the hills to practice their religion. And so Gilliatti is, I don't think that he's like the other six, the other members of the six. And so I think this middle of the road narrative is a way to include him in the September 6th. Mm.
You say that the church leaders found that middle of the road narrative kind of appealing, that they liked that it showed them to others as moderates. Say a little bit more about that, because you write about in the book that in some ways it's great to sort of be perceived as being in the middle because it masks your own political and theological leanings, but also it means that both groups are on the fringe. You're in the middle, and it made it easier, I guess, to dismiss those who were speaking out as being, you know, extremists, not part of the, you know, a broader sensibility among members, that they were just fringes on the right and the left. Bo Greitz was the same as Michael Quinn, is the argument here.
Absolutely. It's just what you said. If you portray yourself in the middle, then what you end up doing is making the other folks in the story extremists. And so putting Mike Quinn and the ultra-conservatives in the same frame, I think is a problem. And so I try to reframe that narrative in terms of the purity system. I think that the goal of the institutional church was to protect the purity system, that the dissenters like Quinn and other members of the six were challenging that the purity system was the heart of the institution. Whereas I think the ultra conservatives were arguing over what purity looked like. And so they were accepting that purity was the frame, but they were saying, for example, they were looking to speeches and talks that Ezra Taft Benson had given as evidence that what they were doing was actually the true church, the true and pure church.
So we were talking about that familial purity, you know, the pillar of the church. That church leaders were trying to preserve. What were some of the September 6 who were intellectuals and feminists, like Claudia Bushman and Maxine Hanks? What was the argument that they were making? Because it seems like it wasn't just a conventional sort of feminist argument, that it did reach back into early ideas of Mormonism, Joseph Smith's maybe earlier teachings, and maybe women, as you say, from the 19th century. In that sense, it seemed like, what was the case that they were making? Because it seems quite uniquely Mormon.
I think part of what they were doing, whether consciously or not, was responding to the argument that church leaders were making that feminism was a foreign set of ideas infiltrating the church. And so part of why they looked to 19th century women was for personal inspiration and a sense of connection. But they were also looking to those women as evidence that these ideas had been in the church all along, that they were part of the Restoration Church. And so There's the individual sense of connection, but then there's also the structural argument that the Restoration Church is going to take women's role seriously, is going to take women's spiritual authority seriously.
Sarah Patterson, her book is The September 6th and the Struggle for the Soul of Mormonism. She's going to be in Utah next month talking about the book. You can find details about those events on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. What happens in September of 1993? One thing happens after the other thing happens after the other thing happens. I mean, it's referred to as the September 6th, and it's thought of as the purge that happens of this moment. But what's playing out on that in that month?
To the question about how much what happened was orchestrated from the top, I don't think that that's an easy question to answer. But I think that there is evidence that with the Strengthening Church Members Committee, that the institution was trying to be more directive with local leaders about the ways that they should police doctrinal purity. I think there's evidence in that. Malcolm Jepson's journal, when he was the president of Utah South, talks about how he was instructed by church leaders basically to clean up shop, that there were a lot of ultra conservatives in that area, and that part of the reason he was chosen was because he was willing to do that. And so he talks about how Gileadi's stake president wasn't being as forceful with pulling Gileadi into line. And so he ended up replacing him so that he could pick somebody who would be more strict in the way that the discipline was meted out. And so I think there's lots of evidence. You know, I did not have access to church leaders' papers about what was happening, but I think that there is evidence that this wasn't just a bunch of local leaders spread apart doing their own thing, that the institution was working to pull people into line.
Yeah. You write in the book that the people who came to be known as the September 6th, that they weren't working together. They didn't have a master plan, you say, to challenge this purity system. And in fact, you write that their challenge to the church actually never really unified, but that it in fact demonstrated, here's how you put it, the diversity that had always been part of the church. Explain what you mean.
I think that what the church was trying to do in pulling people towards this understanding of purity and in trying to pull people towards the church hierarchy was, again, coming out of a sense that people were moving further and further apart, both in terms of their belief and in terms of church membership. And so I think that they were doing that in part because there was diversity in the church and that had been around for a long time. So often when you see people kind of pulling towards an idea that things ought to be one way, what it shows us is that there were lots of different ways in the church. And I think the process of correlation, the strengthening church members committee, all of those were an attempt to pull people away from that diversity of perspectives. Hmm.
How do the surviving members of the September 6th talk about that experience today? Again, they don't all talk about it in the same ways. You have those who have returned to the church, have been rebaptized, Gileadi, Maxine Hanks. You have some who didn't want to return, didn't even try. We'll get to one in a moment here who did try and didn't get back in. But do you hear any common sort of expressions from the six about how they think about that time?
I don't. Actually, I think that there's a general sense that what happened was extreme and that the disciplinary reports didn't represent a loving impulse. So I think that that message is the same.
I'm just wondering how do the surviving members of the September 6th, how do they talk about that experience? How are they reflecting on it? I know they're all different in the way they convey it. And that you, as you said, that you don't see any, how are they talking about it? That was just the question. Yeah.
Yes, they are all different. I think that Lynn Whiteside's came to understand what happened as a moment of liberation for her from a system that was patriarchal and hierarchical and limiting to her spiritually. And so I think her perspective on that time was that she was set free.
Hmm.
And that's very different from Gileadi, who accepted what had happened and accepted that the church needed him to basically ask permission first for what he was writing and saying, and then reentered the church. So I think that all of their experiences were distinct and had to do with where they were when it happened. You know, Maxine Hanks at the time considered herself an agnostic, and so talks about how it was socially hard, it was hard on her with her family, but that spiritually the council wasn't difficult. But then later she wanted to return to the church. While she never said that what she had done in the 1990s was wrong, she really felt it was important to return to community with the people who had even overseen her excommunication.
Yeah. She said in July at the Sunstone Symposium this year, she said that the purge in that September has been viewed as a tragedy that should never have happened. But in her comments, she asked this question, like, what if it was inevitable? You know, what if it had to happen? And she said critical inquiry had kind of reached this critical point in the fall of 1993, and that really it had to play out in public. And it's interesting, she described it as this shift from private to public, a private to public confrontation with itself. Do you think that's right? Do you think that it had reached this critical point and that in some ways it was inevitable and had to play out and sort of shift from the private space to the public space?
I'm always reluctant to say that anything's inevitable, but I do think that her point is important. I think that the church was increasingly moving towards this purity stance, and dissenters were publicly challenging that position. And I think that discourse did need to be heard and aired in public. One of the things that I talk about is in the church, especially at this time, disagreement on a personal or private level was framed as being okay, but to disagree with church leaders publicly was seen as an act of betrayal.
Did it work, the purge in September, in the sense that, you know, whether this was directly orchestrated by the first presidency of the church or whether or not they had just given rather obvious direction indirectly to the local leaders of these, you know, feminists and intellectuals and scholars. But did it work to not just push them back, but to really suspend or put a tamp down maybe a tide of dissent or disorderliness within the church? Like, did it work?
That's a great question. That's really hard to answer. I think that it worked in continuing the idea that the feminist movement was external to the church and dangerous. And it most certainly turned away a lot of, I think, would-be scholars of the history of the church They saw that even if they were interested in the church's history, it was a dangerous field to go into. And so people have talked about kind of a lost generation of scholars. And so I think that in that way, it was effective in terms of the church hierarchy communicating to people, these are questions that we don't want people to be asking. This is history telling that we don't want people to tell. Did it ultimately work?
That's
another question. And I think that it's much harder to measure. But you also see people returning to the questions that were asked by the September 6th. So I guess the answer is, I don't know, ultimately, if it worked.
Let's look at the case of Levina Fielding Anderson. Her story is really interesting. You mentioned Maxine Hanks. One of the things that ultimately drew her back to the church was that she wanted that community. And the way you write about what happened to Levina Fielding Anderson is she went right back to the community. She, even though she hadn't been rebaptized, she went back to church. But she wants to get back in. And in 2019, her high council unanimously sends this letter to the first presidency and says she should be back in. She should be rebaptized. So they submit this. So she gets this questionnaire. She fills it out. And whoever it is that reviewed it, you mentioned, judged it that she was not remorseful enough for what she had done, and she wasn't allowed back in. What do you make of her story?
I think that her story is a really interesting one. The fact that she continued to go to church every Sunday for so long is a testament to her community. She talks about how her community, her ward community, supported her after her excommunication. And I think that that speaks really powerfully to the difference between the institutional church and what's happening at the local level. I also think that she was stubborn, and she was saying that, you know, excommunication doesn't take away my identity as a faithful person. And so that she had a welcoming community that where she could still practice her faith on a, you know, daily level was also its own kind of challenge to the church hierarchy. One of the things that she, in her accounts of her attempts to return to the church, one of the things that she talks about is in that paperwork, she said, I still am concerned about the church's teachings about women. I'm concerned about the church's teachings about LGBTQ members. And I still don't think the church has it right on those issues. And that is an example of Levina pushing back against the purity system still. And I wonder if for the reviewer, that was the concern, that she was still saying, I'm not accepting the whole thing. I'm still going to ask questions, and my personal conscience and my relationship with the Spirit will allow me to challenge what I disagree with.
So let's come back to the story you tell at the beginning of the book of David Wright, not part of the September 6th, but he was one who was excommunicated during that period. I guess the question is, could what happened in September or during that time, would it happen in the same way today? And I was thinking about that conversation David Wright has with his bishop. Would a conventional LDS bishop in any, you know, ordinary ward find it acceptable that David Wright believed, while he viewed Joseph Smith as a prophet, inspired, and believed that the church was good and beneficial, that he didn't believe the Book of Mormon story actually happened, that it was a creation of Joseph Smith? Could he answer those same questions and still stay in the church today? Or is that still the same, that that's a deal breaker within this faith?
I think that that question would be a question that would happen more on the local level and be tied to local church leaders' perspectives. one of the things that I argue is that the church's teachings about gender and family and sexuality have become the doctrinal test. I begin the chapter with a quotation from the Ecclesiastical Clearance Office, which the BYU's created to help determine whether or not potential employees would be good employees. Yeah. And one of the questions that they ask is, does this member have a testimony of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and its doctrine, including its teachings on marriage, family, and gender? And so I think those questions have become the focus of doctrinal concerns.
So they're less interested in the question of, do you believe that the Book of Mormon actually happened, that they've shifted as times have shifted. There's another question, but the point remains, you have to adhere to this doctrinal purity. It is interesting, too, you say that at the local and communal level, that's where the church seems to be changing, that the institution itself, I mean, here's what you write in the book. You say, as the church hierarchy continues to maintain its authority, it's trying to ensure that purity and orthodoxy remains, you know, the standard in these local communities. So that the larger, you know, centralized leadership, they want a certain thing. But you say the local and communal level, that's where the change might be happening. What do you mean by that?
I think a couple of things. One is that the rise of the internet has allowed people who may feel like the only person in their ward who's LGBT or the only person in their ward who feels that women should have the priesthood. It's allowed those people to connect with one another. And so, as we all know, there's a strengthening that comes with feeling like you're part of a community. So I think that's one thing I'm saying about the local and the communal level. The other thing I would say is that there's been a lot of research on Generation Z, and Jana Reese has some fantastic research on this topic. And their willingness to vote with their feet.
To leave.
Yeah.
Right.
And so they feel much more comfortable saying, you know, as a matter of personal conscience, I disagree with the church about LGBT issues. And so I'm not going to be affiliated with this institution anymore. And I think that that generation is pushing back in new ways that previous generations had, but that they're more comfortable just leaving. And so I think the institution is going to have to reckon with that possibility.
Sarah M. Patterson, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Sarah Patterson, she's a professor of theological studies at Hanover College. Her book is The September 6th and the Struggle for the Soul of Mormonism. She's going to be in Utah talking about the book next month, including at the Downtown Salt Lake City Library. You can find information about that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. If you have comments about the show or ideas you want to share, email them to us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Tim Slover and Benjamin Bombard. Our executive producer is Carrie Watson. I'm Doug Fabrizio.